papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat.
From Studio D in the Alan S. Chartock Broadcast Center on lovely Central Avenue in Albany, this is The Media Project. How about that? See, it's pretty cool. I'm Rex Smith, here with my colleagues Judy Patrick, Barbara Lombardo, and Ian Pickett, who is actually our host here for a half-hour commentary and analysis of what's going on in the news media. So let us go around and see what we're about to talk about today, because we have a lot going on. Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette, former vice president of the New York Press Association, what's on your mind?
So I hope we get a chance to talk about poor Scott Pelley. He was a commencement speaker, one of the 60 Minutes anchors. He's taken a lot of blowback for defending the freedom of the press, and I think maybe we should step up and defend him back.
Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy, what's up with you?
I'm going to be wearing my hat as a journalism adjunct at UAlbany and want to talk about how students are under pressure nationwide to not talk to the press.
Same problems that reporters have had in the outside world is now coming to college campuses.
Yes.
All right. Ian Pickus, news director for Northeast Public Radio. What's going on?
Exciting week here for us at WAMC. A couple of things are happening. One is we've been fundraising because our fund drive, our June fund drive, is coming up, and every fund drive is the most important one to date, but I think this one might take the cake, obviously, given what's going on in our country and the threats to the entire public media system as we speak. This is a microcosm of putting all of what we talk about listener-supported local nonprofit journalism to the test in the next few days. At the same time, we are so fortunate. We are onboarding a new managing editor who is known to listeners of this show. He's been a past panelist, Andrew Waite. So we're getting a chance to add to our newsroom staff at a time when so few places in public media and elsewhere are doing so.
Big deal. That's a really good thing. And we really enjoyed having Andrew here. I think, did he become a columnist when you were the editor of the Gazette?
No, after I left in, I was on the show with the Media Project once with him, but oftentimes when I'm not here, he would fill in. Uh-huh. So I missed him. We'll see what he brings to your news operations. It's an exciting time for you.
Yeah,
it really is. And, you know, having fresh eyes and some fresh energy and, you know, thinking about how we can do things better, it's a fun process to be a part of.
Just by the way, to bring in listeners' points of view, we're always glad to get some feedback from listeners. And a sustaining member of WAMC from Columbia County, El Perella, has said how pleased they were for our talking about the media engagement in not covering, let's say, Joe Biden's effectiveness. Especially appreciated, Barbara, your acknowledgement that the media was somewhat complicit. And El says these apologetic phrases were used constantly in the run-up to the election. She heard it, she said, on the roundtable here, and they always seem counterproductive. I think the fear of Donald Trump getting the presidency was so horrifying. Democrats gave Biden a pass when they could very clearly see that he was not able to communicate effectively about his accomplishments or clearly articulate his visions and goals. In retrospect, the Democratic Party needlessly bought into the conspiracy of silence, and I think partial responsibility belongs to the media. So that is actually what we said more or less as well, and we're very glad to get some feedback. So I was really taken also, Judy, by the notion of what's happened to Scott Pelley. By way of background, Scott Pelley, who used to anchor the CBS Evening News, then has become a correspondent in 60 Minutes, gave the commencement address at Wake Forest University. And it didn't register very much until suddenly it was posted on a place where some of his remarks went viral. And he spoke about what's happening in the country with Donald Trump as president without using his name. He said things like, in this moment, our sacred rule of law is under attack. Journalism is under attack. Universities are under attack. Freedom of speech is under attack. And then he said, the fear to speak in America. power can rewrite history with grotesque false narratives. He says there's nothing new in this. It was a very powerful speech. And those of us who have heard a lot of commencement speeches that seem rather dry, those of us who have delivered some, might be impressed by this because it was really a terrific thing. And he concluded by saying, your country needs you. America works well when we listen to those with whom we disagree. So he challenged them to not fail to engage. The result has been that he's been attacked, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, I've seen the original speech and thinking, how can anyone criticize this? And wow, the blowback was incredible. And I went to right-wing sources to try to figure out what their problem was. And their problem was they hate the media. I mean, I have to be as one as I can. There didn't seem to be a logical reason behind the fact that they were so against Scott Pelley being able to say whatever he wanted about the importance of free speech, except that they hate 60 Minutes. And they've, again, these are people in the press oftentimes saying these things. It makes no sense. Far better speech than President Trump gave to the West Point graduates where he talked about, you know, the problems with trophy wife. So again, bravo, Scott Pelley. Keep it up. I wish more journalists would use the form that they have to speak out like this.
But isn't the challenge that we face when you speak the truth, as Scott Pelley did, you're immediately perceived as being an opponent? You are basically presented as being on one side of a fight.
This isn't happening in a vacuum, obviously. The longtime editor of 60 Minutes quit, and it seems to be under some sort of corporate pressure. We know that the parent company is in talks with the Trump administration about its merger. And Scott Pelley, all the while, has been doing some really fearless reporting, not just here in the U.S., but leading CBS coverage of the war in Ukraine. He's put his money where his mouth is, no doubt about it. And I think it's unfortunate that he feels he must sound the alarm in this way. And he knew, obviously, that speech would get some attention because he's CBS's lead star. And I think we've talked about 60 Minutes on this show a lot because of the questions about how Kamala Harris's interview may have been edited, and Donald Trump's refusal to sit for an interview before the election, and so on and so forth. The stories that 60 Minutes has done in the past several months on the new administration have been probing and fair. When DOGE padlocks a federal office building and people who've worked there for 30 years have 1 hour to clear their stuff out, I'm sorry, that is a story.
Yes, it is. And the difficulty confronting CBS is, as you say, that the leadership of Paramount, its ownership, Sherry Redstone, is apparently close to closing a deal with Trump's $20 billion lawsuit against CBS for the way they edited the program that Kamala Harris appeared upon, the 60 Minutes show. And every expert you talk to says that's a preposterous lawsuit. There's no grounds to it. But when you quote that in a story, it only further inflames Trump and his partisans.
It seemed to me that the right is interpreting what Pelley said as a thinly veiled criticism of the Trump administration, which of course it was because of the assault on the First Amendment that's going on right now. Ian, you're right that he felt compelled to have to sound the alarm, and I'm so grateful that he did. These students need to hear, and he put things into context for the graduates as far as assaults on free speech. And I like the way he then turned it around of, who are you? What are you going to do about it? And I hope that those words stick with some of those students in the years to come.
But how do you do this? How do you cover what's going on in this country without seeming to be a partisan?
Very, very difficult to do. It's something we've struggled with here. I talk about this on our news meetings all the time. You know, most of the elected officials we cover here in this part of the country are in resistance mode. And so they are working against the administration to whatever degree they can, and the big, beautiful House bill that passed over all Democratic no votes. And so covering what a lot of people are pointing to as the brink of a constitutional crisis is very hard to do without sounding alarmist and to be fair. And I think what we try to do in our pieces, especially the local ones, is to summarize and explain what the administration says it's trying to accomplish on a variety of fronts, and to make sure that the stories are fair, even if the criticism within the stories is sharp.
You know, you're seeing criticism coming from both sides at this point of the mainstream media. Liberals or Democrats tend to criticize the New York Times a lot for their headlines, believing that they're doing too much sane washing, that they're trying to instead say he gave this wild and crazy speech to the West Point graduates, rather than saying that to saying that he outlined his viewpoints going forward. I mean, it's coming from both directions. But in part, you have to think, yeah, was the craziness of the speech really, should that have been the focus? In retrospect, I think maybe it should have been.
Almost has to be, right? Yeah, yeah. If the press is to be held to account for supposedly not saying enough about Joe Biden's disability in office, that is, losing a bit of steam, is the kind way to put it, as our listener who wrote in today suggested, then what is our responsibility at this point to point out the frankly unhinged nature of comments by the incumbent president?
Can I echo something I think I've said on this show before, which is, with Trump, it's expected, so it's not unusual, and it is not newsworthy that he's at West Point wearing a campaign hat talking about yachts. We're used to it. We've had 11 years of it. Whereas with Biden, we didn't see him as much. Our memory of him was of somebody who was with it, and then suddenly all those illusions were shattered. So I have seen so much criticism of Jake Tapper, who's been on this media tour of late, saying, look, you know, you're putting all this attention on Joe Biden slipping without talking about the fact that President Trump goes up there and never makes any sense. But it's not news with Trump. He is not any different than he's been as a public figure who ran for president starting with the staircase.
But
he's
Ian,
not.
I think that is a big mistake to say that that is not newsworthy. If we don't keep bringing that out front, then we're doing the sane washing that Judy alluded to, that we have to keep reporting. And I mean, that speech was crazy and totally inappropriate. And I would love to see, and maybe this is already on some of the big news sites, that there could be a link to listen to it yourself, read the transcript or listen to it yourself. And that kind of transparency could take a step further if anybody's actually going to look at it, but make those things available, make the actual words available.
Well, I would just say, and I hear what you're saying, I think I agree with you. I'm not saying it's not newsworthy. I'm just saying it's not new.
Yeah. Right. You know, the hard thing is when something that is a problem, a social issue, becomes typical, it is hard to keep it newsworthy. Case in point, emergency rooms in our community are grossly understaffed. It is not at all unusual to wait 7 or 8 hours outside an emergency room. I have known of people who spend 24 hours in hallways while awaiting care because there are no rooms available in the hospitals in the capital region. You don't see stories about that every day in the media, and you kind of wonder, why not? Why aren't we on top of the terrible state of emergency rooms in this community, notwithstanding the change in federal legislation that was supposed to channel $1 billion into upstate hospitals? What's going on, and why is it that there are so many delays? This is a very relevant story for our listeners, but I think that it has become such an accepted notion that you go to an emergency room here, and unless you come in an ambulance in dire straits, you're going to lie there for a long time.
Well, do you think that part of the solution could be the media outlets that would be in a position to cover those things? The Times Union, for instance, if it was an Albany area problem, which it is, would have on their tickler list that we're going to look back at this in 6 months, we're going to look back at this in 1 year, 9 months, whatever it is, so that you are making a strategic, concerted effort to stay on top of stories that you reported and have things changed. We tend to jump after the next, you know, ball of twine like a little kitten. And right now there's tons of things to distract our attention. Yeah. So follow-up is where I think we could do better.
Good point. You know, sometimes, though, editors and producers make decisions based upon wanting to make a key point. I think, for example, of an initiative an editor some years ago undertook, which I disagreed with, but he concluded, this is an editor over in a community newspaper in Massachusetts, that drug use was ruining their little city. And so he decided, I'm going to run the mugshot of every person arrested on drug charges in our community. Now, this is a failed effort because, as we know, arrests don't always lead to convictions. And once you elevate a particular crime above the level of importance, say, that the legislature gives to it, if the drug crime is an E felony as opposed to an A felony, and you put the picture of the drug user in there, I would say there's a problem with it. But it is an editorial decision what you decide to spotlight.
And how to spotlight it. So that clearly was an error in judgment, and that what they ought to have been looking at would have been the bigger pictures of where are the drugs coming from, why is there a drug problem here,
Yeah.
Who's involved and what's the community and law enforcement doing about it, as opposed to just mugshots, which we've all learned the hard way are very problematic.
So what's the social ill that we ought to be reporting that gave rise to the unhinged president that we now have? How do you get the broader story of a president who is, I think by any outward view, fairly, you would say that he's attacking higher education generally. He's attacking fair news coverage. The fair coverage would say that the dismantling of USAID has caused hundreds of thousands of deaths already. I've seen that in one news article. It's hard to write about this stuff and not alienate a whole section of your readers, listeners, viewers.
You know, I think going from abstract to concrete is an effective way of making points. On the West Point speech, for example, the tradition for presidents is to shake the hand of every graduating person from West Point. Franklin Delano Roosevelt did it standing on crutches. Joe Biden did it. Donald Trump did not do it. And when I saw that point, okay, this can be said. These are facts. And that hit home with me that he didn't bother to shake their hands. It's a small thing, but it exemplifies his approach to his job.
I would think that his evangelical supporters would be upset that he took the oath of office without putting his hand on the Bible, which is also a tradition that has been honored for many years. Just an interesting
thing. Well, a related thing that frustrates me is that we maybe deservedly so are giving a lot of attention to his speech, but what about all the other things he is actually doing besides saying that are wreaking havoc in the country? And you're right, Rex, how do you even focus on all of these things?
Yet we persevere. It's the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. If you're just tuning us in, we're always happy to hear from you. Media at WAMC.org. I'm Rex Smith here with Judy Patrick, Barbara Lombardo, and our host, Ian Pickus. And Barbara had a real interest in talking about student journalists because you're there on the UAlbany campus all the time dealing with these young people who are trying to learn the trade and practice the trade.
Yes, you know, as those of us in newsrooms of any medium know, that you take seriously opportunities to shield people from giving their name. And there used to be very limited reasons that you would use their material and give them an anonymity. For example, if someone was a victim of a crime, or somebody's life could be put in danger, or they could convince you that their job would be in danger, they would be retaliated against. That there were limited reasons, and often, I know in my newsroom, I would want to know who that person was, because you're putting the credibility of your news organization on the line by accepting anonymous sources. So it's fraught. So, and it's taken very seriously. It's done reluctantly. Times have changed, and we've seen it in mainstream media that you have to be more open to anonymous sources for various reasons, and now it has trickled down to, or maybe it's bubbling up from, college campuses where school newspapers around the country are finding that it's very difficult to find students who are willing to talk on the record. And it's very difficult to agree to do that yourself. As a journalist at a school paper, you realize that you could be endangering the students who are speaking up, so that there's a much greater willingness to let them speak anonymously, which is still fraught with issues. It's happening right at UAlbany, where I talked to the former editor of the ASP, who's now graduated and is a working journalist now.
The ASP, the Albany Student Press, for
Albany
those
Student
who are
Press.
Not local.
Mm-hmm. Sorry about the jargon. Yeah, so that students are reluctant to talk for fear of two things: the lasting effects of internet content and the Trump administration.
So you mean not just foreign students? You think that other students similarly fear the Trump administration?
Yes. It was definitely foreign students and just regular old students as well. And if it's a student who works for the university and depends on their job with the university, they're reluctant to say anything, even if it has nothing to do with the field that they're in or it has nothing to do with the department they're working for. Yes, the lasting effect of the internet is something we've become more and more aware of.
Yeah, the stuff that you say now stays with you forever.
Yeah.
You know, you made an interesting point, too, that I think is worth us talking about, and that is the difference between somebody refusing to give their name to a reporter and a reporter saying, I will keep your name confidential. Those are very different standards, because we traditionally have enforced the notion of we don't publish just random stuff that somebody might say when it has any consequence. But we do, on certain occasions, and increasingly, allow reporters to say, okay, I promised this person I wouldn't use their name. Probably harder in radio, where you actually have the voices of the person.
You very rarely will hear it in a WAMC news story. I can think of, you know, a few examples in recent years, and they've all been pretty high stakes stuff, like somebody whose sibling was taken away by ICE, you know, who was willing to tell their story, and you feel a certain importance there to protect their identity or maybe to not put it all over the radio. But we almost never will run, you know, anonymous sound or anything like that. We've changed voices a couple of times, but it's a pretty high bar. I was thinking when Barb was talking about student journalists and the challenges they face, we did a story a few years ago about apathetic young people who didn't want to vote in the election, which is a evergreen story, comes around every 2 or 4 years.
Right.
And one of them, you know, I can sympathize with, who was 19 at the time and said, I'm not going to vote and they're all crooks and I don't have any stakes in this. And later, a few years went by and said, can you take that story down? I don't like how I look in the story. And I kind of had to say no, yeah. You know, and that's exactly why, you know, people will think better of things they might have said when they were a teenager.
You know, quite frankly, I've always been grateful for people who have been willing to talk to me on the record and vocally for us, because it takes a certain amount of bravery, even before Donald Trump. I mean, because they are putting themselves out there in the middle of a controversial issue oftentimes, and that can come back to bite them. I'm always been amazed at how easily it was to get people to talk, but then I have always appreciated the fact that they have responded to my request for comment.
And I think it's very difficult now to promise somebody true anonymity. There have to be rules and teaching in newsrooms at schools and around the country of what do you do with your material to protect your anonymous sources? Are there recordings that you want to keep so that you can prove that they said what they said? Or is that going to put them in danger? Are you keeping their notes? Are you, you know, what do you do with the documents that they're providing to help ensure that you really are keeping them anonymous in the long term?
Right. The Trump administration announced that it is taking another deep dive in investigating the leaks of the Dodd Supreme Court decision, for example. So I think people who work at that level have to take even more protections to make sure that the people that are providing them off the record or leaked information are protected going forward. It's going to be much more difficult in the next 3 years.
It's always a tough decision in a newsroom whether you should keep your story notes or whether you should get rid of them. Because if you keep them, that protects you from the claim that you just made up the content. If you destroy them, that basically could lead someone to conclude that you were trying to erase evidence of something going on.
Always keep them.
Always keep them. Well, what your lawyers will tell you, I think, is whatever your usual practice is, follow that.
Exactly.
Don't change your practice if you find that you're likely to be under some pressure from some legal source or another. In any case, these are fraught times for journalists all the way around. And we shouldn't leave the program before talking just a little bit about the nature of the business that we're in. Ian was talking about the fact that we're headed into a fund drive for WAMC, which is really great news. And we know that these are difficult times, especially for public media, for the NPR stations, the PBS stations. And so what's the secret? How do you counter that?
I think we have to, and our boss has said as much, just keep doing what we do and make sure that our house is in order at this time when, you know, we might have a magnifying glass on things. What we're not going to do is take the bait and say, you know, this is opposition radio and everything that the administration is doing is wrong. And look, they've come after us, too. We do local community reporting here, and that is the bread and butter of this station. It is a community conversation place, and the cuts are really directed at national public radio. The effect, which may not be understood so well, is that by targeting the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, many, many, many hundreds of stations could face going out of business, could face severe cuts. And so the effect is sort of diffuse from perhaps what the Trump administration is trying to accomplish by taking on national public radio. And I think if people understand that, you can support the station you hear in your backyard and help keep it going. You'll continue to get stories on your local Common Council. And that's what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. I think it's interesting that the lawsuit against the Trump administration cuts was filed by NPR and by three Colorado stations, local stations in Colorado that serve a variety of markets, including some very small market stations that likely would go out of business without the funding that the federal government has provided. But I wouldn't want to be running one of those stations that is a named plaintiff, I don't think, frankly. That is a scary thing to do. It's the brave thing to do, as Scott Pelley urged the students at Wake Forest, but standing up to the bully is a tough thing.
And Scott Pelley personally is going to be fine. I mean, he's made a lot of money doing news at the top-rated show in the country that does that form of news. And the producer who's graduating from Barb's class, who might catch on as a stringer at the public radio station covering the local environment or whatever for no money, might not be as lucky.
Yeah. Okay, these are tough times, folks, and we hope that you will stand by and stand with us. Thanks very much for being here. That was Ian Pickus, also Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. Special thanks to our producer, Dave Gustina, but really it's to you folks for joining us each week, and we hope you come back again next week for another edition of The Media Project.
Poor old Sadie's on ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, WAMC News Director Ian Pickus, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.